listening to the Sunstone Podcast by the Sunstone Education Foundation, bringing you quality discussions surrounding Mormonism from the recorded audio from our past summer symposiums. Sunstone brings you over 40 years of engaging, thoughtful discussions around Mormonism. Check us out on iTunes under Sunstone Magazine, visit our website at sunstone.org, and join us for our many conferences and events.
Well, I believe we're ready to start. Welcome to... Whoa, man, that's not history. I think I said that right. You would better believe it. We are here to hear from Brother Samuel Taylor, who is, he tells me, a writer. He's written some 14 or 15 books, and he says hundreds of magazine articles. He tells me the only salaried job he's had was in World War II. So, any of you want to contribute to the cause? I understand he has a book on sale here, Family Kingdom, I believe is the name of it. And so, you might want to look that up. It's a great book, we hear, so there's an even better reason to pick it up. Replying to his comments will be Brother Newell Bringhurst, who your program says is an instructor on history and political science at the College of Sequoias. He is also, he tells me, one quarter way through a biography of Fawn Brody. According to my calculations, he has the honor to comment on a commentary on a commentary on a commentary on a man. So, I don't know how much more removed from the Prophet Joseph Smith we can get, but we're trying. Without further ado, we'll hear from Brother Taylor, and then from Brother Bringhurst, and then we'll do some questions.
I believe I can safely say I'm the only person here with a distinction of being a member of the Utah State Prison Chapter of Alcoholics Anonymous. perhaps I should add it's only an honorary membership. I was in Salt Lake for the Utah Writers Roundup, and the warden asked me to talk to the chapter in the prison, and it was a problem because I couldn't tell him to stay sober. The writers I've known, the very best ones, have been heavy drinkers, and one of them, who was the best short story writer I ever knew, he wrote for the great weeklies of yesterday, Saturday Evening Post, Collier's, Liberty, when they were the finest market in the world for a writer. I was also writing for them. But he drank 30 bottles of beer every day. That was his main nourishment. It had lots of calories, but was sort of monotonous. And then, for social occasions, he went to harder stuff. He phoned me one afternoon and said he was coming down to see me in the evening, and so I got ready by getting a gallon of port wine. He arrived drunk, and as we chatted, he drank 8 water tumblers full of port wine and walked out under his own power. He was a man. Another writer who published 140 books for teenagers. He'd smoke 20 cigars a day, and got drunk every night. He prided himself on taking care of his health because he only drank one cup of coffee in the morning. He lived to be 91. He must have been doing something right. I called on him one day. He had just finished another book about the Golden Stallion. He'd been writing about the Golden Stallion for I don't know how many years. He'd written so many books about it that he was stuck for a title. What to call this latest one? I suggested he call it Silver Threads Among the Golden Stallion. At any rate, speaking of the word of wisdom, I've been the envy of Zion for many years because I have a doctor's prescription for coffee. And I took my medicine in mid-morning, mid-afternoon, a habit I picked up in England during World War II. But something happened just a few months ago. I developed a violent allergy to coffee, and I was thrilled because intellectuals are notorious for having allergies, and it's the first time in my life I had a hint that I was getting smart. Anyhow, my paper. The moving finger writes, and having writ, moves on. Nor all thy piety, nor wit, shall lure it back to cancel half a line. Nor all thy tears wash out a word of it. That's from the Rubaiyat of Omar Khayyam. He tried, Omar, to revise what was writ. Yes, Khayyam, with all his poetry and wit, he tried to cancel half the lines. Yet with all his jeers, it didn't come out in the wash. But give him A for effort. He was the man of the hour when Fawn M. Brody's No Man Knows My History exploded like an atom bomb in Deseret in 1945. World War II had ended, but the Brody War is still raging with no end in sight. As a result of the furious publicity, her book is still in print, having sold more than 500,000 copies. An advertising maxim is, it doesn't matter what you say about a product, just spell the name right. Every knock is a boost. The Brody Bashers couldn't have done a better sales campaign if the author had paid them for it. The original edition had 8 printings. The second edition, revised and enlarged, had 10 printings by February 1982. This is the latest copy I have. Since then, there's been no let up in the Brody bashing. In fact, among devout LDS scholars and historians, to blast Brody has become virtually synonymous to bearing testimony. The man of the hour when the Brody bomb burst was Hugh Nibley, Ph.D., with his No Ma'am, That's Not History, which takes Brody apart piece by piece for 62 pages. Beautifully written and powerfully persuasive, it is one of the most successful book reviews ever written. It was published in 1946, and my copy of the 1969 edition is of the 9th printing. If the Brody book had simply been ignored in Utah, it would have quietly gone out of print. Sam Weller, the Zion bookstore, told me the sales had dwindled at the time Mrs. Brody was excommunicated and Dr. Nibley launched the highly successful publicity campaign. The Brody brouhaha has made her book obligatory reading for untold thousands of saints. Numbers of the devout know without reading it that the book is a pack of lies because Hugh Nibley said so. However, a Salt Lake librarian told me that some of them, drawn by the lure of evil, have checked it out while bringing their own dust covers so that they were apparently carrying out the discourse of Brigham Young or priesthood and church government. A San Francisco book dealer, Tro Harper, told me he disposed of very few copies in the winter, but sales were brisk in summer when tourists from Zion, where purchase of the book could be risky, could buy it with impunity. Everything has two sides, just ask any lawyer. And I wonder why nothing has come to my attention of the accuracy of Dr. Nibley's famous No Ma'am. In the 1969 edition, in fact, he says, more than a decade of research abetted by correspondence with Mrs. Brody's defender has failed to discredit a single observation made in our 1946 review, which is reprinted here with only a few typographical corrections. This claim of perfection brought a knee-jerk reaction from me. Dr. Nibley says the gospel as the Mormons know it sprang full-grown from the words of Joseph Smith. It has never been worked over or touched up in any way and is free of revisions and alterations. He also said if Joseph Smith were to walk into a conference of the Mormon Church today, he would find himself completely at home, and if he were to address the congregation, they would never for a moment detect anything the least bit strange, unfamiliar, or old-fashioned in his teachings. Well, there's some difference of opinion regarding this. Keith A. Norman, in his How Long, O Lord, said that Mormonism has experienced a social and intellectual transformation of such magnitude that a resurrected Joseph Smith returning to earth today might well wonder if this was indeed the same church he had founded. I rose to the challenge with a paper, Joseph Smith Visits Redwood City First Ward, in which he finds conditions in my ward so different that he not only cannot qualify for a temple recommend, but today would be excommunicated for refusing to sustain the first presidency without first discussing their worthiness. So I would conclude that a few changes have been made, including 3,913 in the Book of Mormon, which have evidently escaped Dr. Nibley's notice. He pooh-poohs Brody's whispered talk, which attests the activities of the Danites, comparing it to the stories once current about the nocturnal orgies of the early Christians and the child-eating rites of the Jews, which simply weren't true. While these stories weren't true, the Danite activities most certainly were. Senate Document 189, published the transcript of testimony on the trial of Joseph Smith Jr. and others for high treason and other crimes against the state in the 5th District Court of Missouri at Richmond, which began 12 November 1838. Its 47 pages of testimony include 37 witnesses who testified of a secret band of terrorists bound by a covenant of silence. Those who talked would be put to death, who met mob violence with violence. The band was also known as the Avenging Angels, as the Brothers of Gideon, and as the Daughters of Zion, for being sometimes disguised in female costume. The term Danites referred to the scriptural passage regarding the little stone of Daniel that would roll forth and crush all opposition. John C. Bennett, in his History of the Saints, devoted several chapters to Danite activities. Though Bennett wrote with venom, he had been assistant president to Joseph Smith and knew what went on. In addition, Thomas B. Marsh, former president of the 12 Apostles, made affidavit to Danite raids on Gentile property. But both he and Orson Hyde, who corroborated his testimony, were excommunicated. Hyde was reinstated to membership in the 12. Dr. Nibley's big gun in bombarding Brody was an obscure book published at Halle, Germany, in 1912. Excuse my German, but as I read it, its title was Upsprung und Geschichte der Mormonen. Its author was the most learned man who ever made a study of the Mormons and one of the best informed men who ever lived, Dr. Nibley said. At the end of the last century, the great tradition of European scholarship in the grand manner culminated in the person of Edward Meyer. To his famous rotunda at the University of Berlin flowed as it has never flowed since all the learning of the ages for his examination and exploitation. This prodigious paragon went to Utah in 1904 to devote a year of his precious time to studying the Mormons. Few churches have had the good fortune to be examined at first hand to a man of such vast learning and complete impartiality. However, Dr. Nibley fails to mention that the great man's impartial conclusion was, "There is no doubt that the golden plates never existed in the actual sense of the word." Even if reports of Smith's mother and others claim that they had lain in the box in Smith's home, whether or not he brought back a block of stone, a heap of sand, or something similar from his diggings in the hill Camorra, or if there was simply nothing in the box, it is not possible to determine. According to testimonies which Howe gathered in the area and those from the trial of Martin Harris's wife versus Smith, Smith more than once admitted there was nothing but sand in the box, or that he was merely playing a trick on all concerned and wished to make money. Above all, the double nature of his mind, as in cases involving similar personalities, played a decisive role. For him, the plates were certainly in the box, even if others, as well as himself, could not see them in a normal state. As soon as he returned to the visionary state, they were again there. Meyer is frankly skeptical of the accepted story. He says the Book of Mormon witnesses experienced a common vision conjured up by circumstance and the prophet's power of suggestion. Meyer also claims that the restoration of the higher priesthood by Joseph and Oliver Cowdery by Peter, James, and John in June 1829 was an afterthought. Cowdery's account says nothing of the matter, he points out. Not only is there no revelation concerning the subject, even the date is not specifically stated, but all the older documents show that this is a later invention of Smith's. Dr. Nibley chides Mrs. Brodie for stating that the writing of the first 116 pages of the Book of Mormon was painfully slow, for Joseph had not yet learned how to write. Yet, says Dr. Nibley, less than a year later, we find him tossing off a 275,000-word manuscript in 3 months. This statement is based on the date of copyright. Evidently, the learned doctor was unaware that during that period, all that was necessary for securing a copyright for a book consisted of one sheet of paper, the title page. The book was by no means written in 3 months. Studies have been made of the various scribes and the length of time involved in the book's composition, and I'm sure this information is available at BYU. My own research indicates a period of approximately 10 months. As an author, by the way, I am not impressed by the speed of composition. Some of my confreres in the writing business have been amazingly prolific. Two of my friends between them wrote every word of 3 monthly pulp magazines for a period of years. They were fully aware that the output was complete soft porn trash, but the money was good. Meyer definitely had a low opinion of both Joseph Smith and his family. At the time Joseph married Emma Hale in 1827, many documents relating to his activities described him as an uncouth, shy, and lazy boy who told strange tales which appear to the listener as boasts or lies, Meyer reported. Neither he nor his family were well thought of. They were especially accused of dipsomania, in other words, drunks, or in the polite word of 1912, alcoholics. Today we'd use the politically correct term substance abusers. In a footnote, he states that while such reports stem from anti-Mormon persecution in 1833, nonetheless, they give us the general opinion of his neighbors in their true essential form. At this point, it seems incredible that Dr. Nibley should hold such enormous respect for Meyer's research. It simply couldn't be that he assumed nobody would actually find and read the great man's actual statements, because at the time of the ninth edition of No Man in 1969, Meyer's book had been translated into English and in circulation for 8 years. The Origin and History of the Mormons, the Reflections on the Beginnings of Islam and Christianity, translated by Heinz F. Brody and Eugene C.H., was published by the University of Utah in 1961. To assume that the BYU faculty was unaware of this, and in particular the learned Dr. Nibley, is simply beyond belief. Yet, with the arrogance of hubris, he boasts that everyone has failed to discredit a single observation of our 1946 review. Meyer's appraisal of Mormonism is that the unique position of Mormonism, which distinguishes it from all other Christian sects, is not the fact that it is merely a new sect among countless others, but rather a new religion based upon continuous revelation. However, he states that among revealed religions, it is one of the most unsophisticated and least intellectual. In his opinion, its appeal was primarily to the lower classes. A typical quotation says the Gentiles could see in the new prophet a charlatan or look upon his message as a crude swindle. The life and activities of his followers, most of whom were recruited from the dregs of the populace, were extremely revolting, and we hear the prophet raging often enough against them for their sexual misbehavior. Compare this statement with Dr. Nibley's appraisal of the great man's judgment. He was neither partial nor hostile to the Mormons, who, so far as his feelings were concerned, might have been beans on another planet or a heap of ants. While it is true that Dr. Nibley frankly admits that Meyer is in fact far less sympathetic than Brody, I have to wonder why he gives Fawn the death of the thousand cuts while fawning over the very ground Meyer walks on. He explains this is because with his infinitely greater knowledge, he reaches such totally different conclusions. In view of Meyer's assertion that the golden plates never existed, that neither Joseph nor his family were well thought of, being especially accused of dipsomania, and that it was primarily the extremely revolting dregs of the populace who believed in the most unsophisticated and at least intellectual religion, I am forced to conclude by the law of parsimony that the simplest explanation that fits the facts is that Dr. Nibley's statement is horseradish. However, Meyer's book is well worth reading, and among the brickbats are occasional nuggets. He says, the opponents of the church have often raised the question as to how the absurd tales of the Book of Mormon and the foolish revelations of the prophet, which contradict all reason, could be literally accepted as God's communication to man, and how Smith's followers could have deluded themselves by believing in their prophet's divine calling in view of his human weaknesses and the crimes he committed. The answer which they offer is decisive and irrefutable. The Bible also contains numerous stories which are as absurd as those in the Book of Mormon. God's ways are not those of man, and a human scale of values may not be imposed upon his actions. Man shall rather humble himself and accept the divine will and its manifestations as such. And looking at the moral scruples of Smith, there again is no problem for the believer. Assuming that the accusations against him are true, does not the Bible tell of grave sins and misdeeds committed by Abraham, Moses, David, and Solomon, men who nevertheless were chosen prophets of God? God chooses whom he will, without having to give an account of himself. Apparently, as these stories teach, he has a predilection for sinners and criminals. Thus, all reproaches against Smith's character can cast no suspicion on his inspiration. He remains a chosen instrument of God, who chose him as his mouthpiece. Herein lay the strength of the church and the secret of the powerful propaganda which it exerted. In its midst was a genuine prophet from whom the living God resounded, a steady source of advice for every contingence which might arise, and a fulfillment of the ancient biblical prophecies which others vainly sought to discredit. As for Fawn Brodie's book, I have said it before and I will say it again. If it is so absolutely awful, just why hasn't someone with more accurate knowledge and better spirit, such as Dr. Hugh Nibley, written a better one? Why has the entire coterie of Brodie bashers spun their wheels publicizing the book instead of writing a better and correct one? As it stands, I consider No Man Knows My History the best book yet written about Joseph Smith, despite its very serious faults. Newell Jean Bringhurst, who has written more about Fawn Brodie than anyone else, agrees, saying it is best by default. There are two major faults in the book as I see it. First, Mrs. Brodie enters Joseph's mind, telling his thoughts, his subjective motivations. Although we know what he said, what he did, and what he wrote, Joseph himself said, "No man knows my history, nor can anyone enter his mind." The second fault, which the book's bashers seem to have entirely overlooked, is even more serious in my estimation. At the time Fawn was doing research, Professor M. Wilford Polson, head of the psychology department at BYU, had broken the code of James Strang's diary. Strang had attempted to take over leadership of the church after Joseph Smith's death. That failing, he founded his own brand of alleged Mormonism and became known as King Strang of Beaver Island. His journal is characterized by sanctimonious sentiments. Butter wouldn't melt in his mouth. However, parts of it were in code. Why? What is vitally important but must be hidden? In breaking the code, Polson found that it revealed the actual reason why Strang became a self-proclaimed prophet. It was the way to wealth, adulation, fame, power, and all the pretty girls he wanted. Polson's translation of the code was circulating among scholars at the time Fawn was doing research, and he told me he showed it to her. Unfortunately, she applied Strang's motivations and aims to Joseph Smith. Polson was greatly upset when Mrs. Brodie's book was completed on 5 January 1945. Prior to the book's publication, he wrote her, "Frankly, I had hoped your presentation would be more worthy of being characterized as definitive. I had hoped you would bring to bear the appropriate canons of historical criticism upon your sources. I believe that the future truly great biography of the Prophet Joseph Smith will not ungenerously trim him down to the proportions of a liar, an impostor, an adulterer, and anything else mostly bad." He later wrote again, asking her not to mention his name. He didn't want to be connected in any way to a book he strongly disapproved. Polson had himself aspired to write the definitive biography of Joseph Smith. For decades, he had collected books, manuscripts, papers, graduate studies, journals, and magazine stories relating to early Mormonism. He had, for example, collected every single book in the library at Manchester, New York, to which Joseph Smith had access. One day he swore me to secrecy and took me down into his basement, which was filled from floor to ceiling with rows of bookshelves, and almost the entire shelf space was filled with his research materials. Unfortunately, he spent so many years in research that time ran out for him. However, he donated his materials to BYU, so someone there would have this rich source of primary material in the event anyone should have the courage to try to write a better book than Mrs. Brodie's. No one yet has done it. It won't be easy. Some years ago, Ted Cannon of Church Information Service told me flatly, no New York book about the Mormons has ever been approved in Utah at the time of publication. This was hard to believe. I asked, how about John Henry Evans, Joseph Smith, an American prophet? No, it wasn't accepted. Two men from McMillan came to Salt Lake to straighten things out, but they got nowhere. Subsequently, there have been exceptions. However, Vardis Fisher's Children of God, a Harper's Prize-winning novel, was so violently rejected that Fisher never again wrote about his people. Virginia Eggerson was a beautiful classmate of mine at BYU, and I dated her once. Her first book, A Little Lower Than the Angels, written after her marriage to Fred Sorensen, was blasted, and she became alienated. I wonder how many LDS authors of talent and goodwill have been silenced, shattered, or alienated by a situation where a writer fears and trembles for the law, and nobody knows what the law is. Maureen Whipple's monumental novel, The Giant Joshua, was furiously damned as anti-Mormon literature for almost a half century, yet now is considered by some BYU professors as the best Mormon novel. Mrs. Whipple's projected literary career was shattered by the withering reaction. She had intended Joshua to be the first of a trilogy, but never wrote the other two. Family Kingdom, the biography of my family, of my father and his six families, was denounced by a church official who called it lies, lies, lies. He phoned the Salt Lake bookstore, which had scheduled an autograph party, causing it to cancel the event and cut the original order of 400 copies to 12. Yet Dr. Kenneth Hunsaker of Utah State University, in a survey of modern LDS literature, listed it as best Mormon biography. At BYU, it was listed as fiction. As an indication of how far we have gone in canceling what the moving finger has writ, when I was doing research for the book Nightfall at Nauvoo, I obtained the six volumes of the official LDS publication at Nauvoo, The Times and Seasons, in which the living Joseph Smith tells his own story. And just where did I obtain this invaluable source material? You must believe me when I tell you I purchased it from Modern Microfilm, published in photocopy by the Tanners as anti-Mormon literature. I must admit that I like Joseph Smith's own story, told in his own words, far better than it exists now. Prettified, emasculated, dehydrated, homogenized, and butlerized by those who, albeit with the highest motives, made him a man, a person without fault or blemish. I liked Joseph as he was, full of life, with a good sense of humor, who as a youth faced the struggles of most of us in attempting to conquer the flesh to save the soul. He says, during the time I had the first vision and the year 1823, I was left to all kinds of temptations and mingling with all kinds of society. I frequently fell into many foolish errors and displayed the weakness of youth and the corruption of human nature, which I am sorry to say led me to divers temptations, to the gratification of many appetites offensive in the sight of God. And it was when I took myself to prayer and supplication to Almighty God for forgiveness of all my sins and follies that the angel Moroni appeared to him for the first time to tell him of the golden place. However, at this time he is not ready to receive them. It was not until the fourth yearly visit that he had developed spiritually and had grown in understanding to the stature of prophet that he was entrusted with the plates. This honest story of a youth's struggle with himself has been revised. The corruptions of human nature now are foibles. Then there is an interpolated statement which Joseph never made. In making this confession, no one need suppose me guilty of any greater malignant sins. A disposition to commit such was never in my nature. But I was guilty of levity, and sometimes associated with jovial company, etc., not consistent with that character, which must be maintained by one who is called of God as I had been. In revising the youth's struggle with the flesh, one common with spiritual leaders throughout the world for centuries, in making Joseph into a prissy eaten with torment because of being guilty of levity, I must wonder if his idolaters realize what their inventions have done to damage the prophet. Gerald and Sandra Tanner, in their Changes in Joseph Smith's History, detail more than 62,000 words added or deleted in the first six volumes. Even so, the Tanners overlook some changes, a notable example being concerning Sidney Rigdon, a comparison of the conference minutes as originally published in the Times and Seasons and as revised in the DHC will reveal exactly opposite accounts of what occurred. And so, no, it won't be easy to write a better biography of Joseph Smith than Mrs. Brodie's. And I fully understand why not a single one of the Brodie bashing coterie has undertaken the Donny project. But until it is done, we'll just have to be content with what we have. To date, the Brodie book is best of show, like it or lump it. Omar Khayyam asked, I often wonder what the vintners buy, one half so precious as the goods they sell. And I often wonder what our inventors buy, one half so precious as the good they sell out. Thank you.
What would really be ideal, I was just sitting here thinking about this, would be if we could, through the miracle of science or replication, that we could have Hugh Nibley here. I'd like, and through even a greater miracle of science, is perhaps bring Fawn Brodie back and have those two on the same platform. That would, unfortunately, with the Fawn Brody's untimely death in 1981. That, of course, is impossible. But anyway, so I guess you have to have Sam and I kind of stand in for Fawn and Hugh Nibley. I consider it a real privilege to comment on this paper, and Sam Taylor, in his characteristically witty style, has given us a most insightful, penetrating critique of Hugh Nibley's No, Ma'am, That's Not History, the BYU professor's famous 1946 rejoinder to Fawn M. Brody's No Man Knows My History. I agree with virtually all of Taylor's comments, particularly concerning Nibley and his less than perfectly written assault on Fawn Brody's biography. There are, however, two or three points made by Taylor that I would like to comment on. First, although I feel that Sam Taylor has done an excellent job in exposing the numerous fallacies in Hugh Nibley's arguments, I feel that Taylor gives Nibley much too much credit as a premier critic of No Man Knows My History. While I certainly agree with Taylor that Nibley's No Ma'am, That's Not History is one of the most successful book reviews ever written, at least in terms of commercial success, I question what is obviously Taylor's tongue-in-cheek observation, that Taylor's critique was beautifully written and powerfully persuasive, or that it really takes Brody apart piece by piece for 62 pages, unquote. Seriously, I question Taylor's contention that Nibley was really the man of the hour when Fawn M. Brody's No Man Knows My History exploded like an atom bomb in Deseret in 1945. Hugh Nibley's No Ma'am, That's Not History is neither the first nor the most effective contemporary critique of Brody's biography. In fact, contrary to what Taylor has suggested, spokesmen for the Mormon Church did not immediately attack No Man Knows My History in the wake of its publication in November 1945. Indeed, the Church publicly ignored No Man Knows My History when first published, behaving as if the biography did not even exist. In the words of Brody herself, the biography, quote, met thunderous silence in Zion, quote. In private, however, Church leaders did manifest extreme concern, with Fawn's own uncle, David O. McKay, apparently initiating a resolution before the 12, calling for Brody's immediate excommunication as early as the fall of 1945. But the matter was tabled on the grounds that it would make a martyr of Fawn Brody. Finally, however, in March 1946, No Man Knows My History warranted public condemnation by Latter-day Saint spokesmen. The Church could no longer ignore Brody's biography because by this time it had been reviewed extensively in the Eastern press, including such publications as the Saturday Review of Literature, Time Magazine, Newsweek, and the New York Times. Brody's biography, moreover, was enjoying universally brisk sales throughout the United States, particularly within the Mormon-dominated Great Basin. Sales that were reflected in the fact that the book was in its third printing by this time. Apostle John A. Witzel was the first to weigh in with his criticism of Brody's biography through the pages of the Improvement Era. And 2 months later, in May of 1946, the Church News section of the Deseret News carried a lengthy critique written by a church committee, of which Apostle Albert E. Bowen was apparently the principal author. Finally, in late May, came Hugh Nibley's No Ma'am, That's Not History. Besides its dilatory appearance, Nibley's critique was also inferior in the quality of its criticism and analysis. Nibley's much overrated work is inferior not only to the presentations of Witzel and Bowen, but also to the reviews of two other Mormon Church spokesmen, namely Milton R. Hunter and Francis W. Kirkham, both of whom also wrote extensive critiques of Brody's biography at about the same time. This being said, however, one has to go outside of official Mormon circles to find the most insightful and probing of all the critiques to appear in the immediate aftermath of Brody's book. This is the rather provocative review by noted Utah-born author Vardis Fisher, appearing in the New York Times in November 1945. By contrast, Nibley's critique of No Man Knows My History suffers. Brody herself betrayed her own limited respect for Nibley's commentary in a letter written to her parents immediately following its publication. Quote, "It is a flippant and shallow piece," Brody noted. "He really did me a service by demonstrating the difference between his scholarship and mine. If that is the best a young Mormon historian can offer, then I am all the more certain that the death of B.H. Roberts meant the end to all that was truly scholarly and honest in Orthodox Mormon historiography," unquote. By contrast, Brody was much more interested in and concerned about what Francis M. Kirkham, and especially Vardis Fisher, had to say relative to her scholarship. Moving away from Hugh Nibley, whom I feel we have given more attention than he probably deserves, I want to turn to a second point that made by Taylor, specifically what he feels to be the two major faults in Brody's biography. The first is Taylor's concern that Brody enters Joseph's mind, telling his thoughts, his subjective motivations. The second fault, noted by Taylor, is his most interesting observation, the BYU psychology professor M. Wilford Polson's discovery of schismatic Mormon leader James J. Strang's secular motives in becoming a self-proclaimed prophet unduly influenced Brody in forming the basis of her own naturalistic portrait of Joseph Smith. I generally agree with Taylor concerning these two major faults, but I would go one step further in suggesting two additional and in some ways interrelated problems affecting the quality of Fawn Brody's Joseph Smith. The first involves Brody's own long-held preconceived views concerning Joseph Smith's basic motives, views held long before she came into contact with M. Wilford Polson and his disclosures concerning James J. Strang. Brody clearly and frankly indicated the point at which she came up with her preconceived image of Mormonism's founder. I quote, "I was convinced before I ever began writing that Joseph Smith was not a true prophet," unquote. Indeed, Brody was committed to a naturalistic interpretation of Mormon origins long before she began her research on Joseph Smith. Brody's belief, or rather disbelief, on this point was evident as early as 1936 while a student at the University of Chicago. It came as the result of being confronted with what she described as, quote, "overwhelming scientific evidence that the American Indians are Mongoloid." As a result, she continued, "I was no longer a good Mormon." By the time that Brody actually began her research, she wrote her uncle, Dean Brimhall, the following, quote, "I have had the most fun with the Book of Mormon, and I was able to trace almost every idea in it right down to Ontario County, New York, 1827. The Lost Tribe theory, the exterminated races theory, anti-Masonry, anti-Catholicism, the whole gamut of sectarian religious controversy, all of which make up the Book of Mormon," unquote. A second major problem, which I feel unduly influenced the basic tone and tenor of Brody's biography, stems from the author's own self-proclaimed motives for writing the book. Brody, in an extremely revealing letter to close friend and confidant, Dale L. Morgan, on the 19th of January, 1946, just after the book had been published, stated the following, quote, "The book served for me what an autobiographical novel usually does for the young novelist. It was a kind of catharsis." Brody then added, quote, "But there was compulsion to self-expression, too. as well as a compulsion to liberate myself wholly from Mormonism, and perhaps also from certain family relationships, unquote. Brody revealed an even deeper-seated motive to her uncle, Dean R. Brimhall. She confessed that No Man Knows My History represented, quote, a desperate effort to come to terms with my childhood. Despite these basic problems, however, No Man Knows My History is still by default the closest thing to a definitive biography of the Mormon leader that we have. An assertion that I initially made some 5 years ago, in fact, at a Sunstone Symposium down in L.A., and continue to hold right down to the present time. This is the case even with the publication of 4 book-length studies on Joseph Smith that have come out in the last 25 years. These include Carl Karmer's The Farm Boy and the Angel, published in 1970. Donna Hill's Joseph Smith, the First Mormon, which appeared in 1977. Francis M. Gibbons' Joseph Smith, Martyr, Prophet of God, also published in 1977. And Richard L. Bushman's Joseph Smith, The Beginnings of Mormonism, which came out in 1984. Each of these 4 biographies have limitations, which I feel have prevented any of these from supplanting No Man Knows My History as the most definitive biography of the Mormon leader. Thus, paraphrasing Sam's colorful prose, to date, the Brody book is the best of the show, like it or lump it. The reasons for the acute failure to produce a more definitive biography on Joseph Smith are complex, some of which Sam has incisively pointed out in his presentation today. Nevertheless, I still find it surprising, and indeed a little appalling, that a more comprehensive, thoroughly researched, and more deftly written biography on Joseph Smith has yet to be produced. I make this assertion in light of a number of important scholarly developments that have occurred over the course of the past 50 years since the publication of No Man Knows My History. In that time, the number of scholars in the field of Mormon studies has increased exponentially, with a large segment of these specifically trained in historical methodology. Training which, incidentally, Brody herself lacked. In addition, there is available to the would-be scholar critical primary source materials, including numerous writings by Joseph Smith himself and his contemporaries, many of which were unknown by and or unavailable to Fawn Brody back in the late 1930s and 1940s. Finally, there has been the emergence of the so-called New Mormon History, combined with critical historiographical trends in the larger fields of American religious studies and American social cultural history. Such developments have opened up whole new vistas of opportunity for historical inquiry, as reflected in the publication of such important recent books as the late Harold Bloom's The American Religion, a book which I highly recommend. It was mentioned this morning in the session that I attended. I urge you to read that book. It gives Joseph Smith and Mormonism an extremely prominent place. It's called The American Religion. It's by Harold Bloom, B-L-O-O-M, Bloom. All of these developments, I firmly believe, has made the writing of a comprehensive, updated analysis of the life and times of Joseph Smith not only possible, but absolutely mandatory. In this spirit, and with more than a little irony, Fawn M. Brody herself made this following observation clear back in 1975, quote, "I assumed that by now there would be a better biography than mine to come along. It is astonishing to me that there has not been, unquote. I can only echo Fawn Brody's observation 18 years later and some 50 years after the initial publication of No Man Knows My History. Thank you.
Officially, we're out of time, but if there's one or two quick questions or comments, I'd like to take them. Yes.
Yeah, I cut that out of my paper because I'm running short on time. That's what happens when you start cutting and trimming and everything else, because that was one of the areas that... I'll just go through it very quickly. Carmers, the farm boy and the angel, he started out to write an in-depth definitive biography. He was a New York writer. He'd written a very good writer. But he ended up, for various reasons, writing a short, popular narrative on the church's early years. You know, Sam Taylor himself has written a colorful presentation in which he discusses Carmer's ordeal called Faith, Mythology, and the Curious Case of the Bye-Bye Brody Book. Maybe he'll treat us to this at one of the future Sunstone Symposium. Donna Hill, who has written the second book that I talked about, she incorporated, her book is probably a good counter or a good thing to read alongside Brody, because she incorporates a great deal of the current scholarship of the so-called New Mormon history. But I feel Donna Hill's book suffers from chronic organizational problems. I don't think she could quite make up her mind whether she was writing a biography on Joseph Smith or writing a history of the church during Joseph Smith's lifetime. And it comes across as somewhat stalled and flat. And it doesn't really capture the spirit and the mood suffers from problems there. And Francis M. Gibbons, Joseph Smith, Martyr Prophet of God. I think that's by far the most inferior of anything that has appeared. Gibbons is a general authority, I think he's still a general authority, he's in the second quorum of the 70, is little more than a faith-promoting hagiography. Which means it goes out, it's the kind of thing that Sam Taylor expressed contempt for. If you want to read us an example of the type of history that should not be written about Joseph Smith, I'd unrecommend the Francis Gibbons book. And finally, Richard L. Bushman. It's another scholarly book. Bushman just recently, he has an endowed chair at Columbia University. And he has done a good job as far as he goes, but it's not really a true biography, because he only takes Joseph Smith's life up to 1831. He just stopped at 1831, and he talks about Joseph Smith and the origins of Mormonism. That's the title of the book, and even though it received the Evans and Evans Award for the best biography, for reasons that I can't quite figure out, it is not a complete biography, but it does give you a feel for the early origins, and he utilizes a lot of the New Mormon history and documents that were unavailable to Fawn Brody, but he also, I think, he dodges some big issues too. I feel like Bushman has dodged some critical issues, but so as I say by default, that's part of my paper I left down here. It comes back. Okay.
Thank you very much. I'm afraid we're just about out of time. Let you gab and purchase fun things outside.